O Lord of Beards Red! Lord of Snakes White!
Hello, this is David What's my name? Okay. Hello, this is David Coverdale in the studio for Whitesnake. Well, that's probably the premier festival, certainly. You know, I always consider it a British festival, but, you know, they get people from all over the continent. And Americans. I've seen American flags being waved in the crowd there. It's a great event to perform. I've played, I think, 3 or 4 times there. Something like that. I think the last time was in 90. And as a matter of fact, I was asked in 95 when Adrian Vandenberg and I were sitting in my home writing songs to headline it in 94. And I said, I don't even have a band. You know, I'm just writing here. I'm not going on with a bass drum on my back and a couple of knee cymbals. acoustic guitar. Hey, Bill! You know, reluctantly. I actually recommended Metallica. I said they'd go to the opening of an envelope, you know. So they did that. And so I don't know. According to the media, you know, things have changed so much. I don't think there's an enormous environment for alternative music in a festival thing in Europe. That's the strange thing. Because it's always been really rock, you know, the big rock and roll theatrics or whatever to make those kind of things work, you know, sort of larger than life scenarios. Are you ready?
Is this on fire? Are you a sight for sore fucking eyes, Donny Turner? Yeah. The sun's out at midnight, the evening to rise.
I think people want to be entertained again. I think, you know, some of the relevant, more or regarded as relevant bands, I think, with the suicidal themes and stuff like that, I think they've had a good run. But I think people want to have a bit of a smile on the face again now and be a little more optimistic than pessimistic. Well, I speak to a lot of people in Radio Red, and the song, it's, I don't know whether to blame the record companies, whether it's a master plan that they kill the fatted calf. You know, how many Alanis Morissettes do they think we want? How many Pearl Jams do they think we want? You know, they'll see something that strikes oil and then sign tons of things that remotely resemble that particular success. And then they kill it off. You know, they saturate to the point where you go, enough already, you know? And that's very sad. But the cream, I've found in my experience, that the cream always rises to the surface. Saints and Sinners. Well, the circumstance was I felt that the band, I think my quote at the time was that the band were cruising on gold status and I was hungry for platinum. And which is basically it. I was finding myself doing more and more and more in the studio, and the pressure was on top of me all the time. And I think the straw that broke this old camel's back was the guitarist Bernie Marsden we discussed earlier, who called me up one day and was going, look, why don't you do what I do? Just come home from the tour and go to the pool hall, shoot some pool. And I was so insulted. I said, Bernie, if I didn't do this, we wouldn't have any songs. We're in the studio next week, you know. I can't afford the luxury of doing that. If you were at home writing songs, that'd be fine, you know. But, and that was it. So basically, I used the Saints and Sinners record, which I now regard as a contractual album, and I really very rarely consider that as a Whitesnake record. I was the only one who knew how to finish it, and the manager had already taken lots of advances from different companies, so he had to comply with a relatively reasonable settlement in order for me, and my only ace in the hole was to finish the top and tail the Saints and Sinners record.
Oh,
the management that I was involved with was basically the Deep Purple company. Well, yeah, when I signed, you know, the Purple agreements or whatever, those were, I think, 10-year agreements at that time. And so I was really saddled with them, and it was getting extremely frustrating, taking 6 steps forward and then sliding back 8, you know, doing 3 German tours instead of 1 where people go, oh, this is going to be the only opportunity we have of seeing the band. You know, oh, we wait till they come around next time. It was just really stupid, you know, career misguidance. But the very important thing at that in 81, I was extraordinarily frustrated with the way that my career was, and my management was making any and every kind of deal, one-off deals with American labels. Who, you know, for instance, there was a Bob and Jerry Greenberg had Mirage Records, which was basically a Now You See It, Now You Don't, an aptly named company. You know, yeah, appropriate. And they released, I think, of an album called Come and Get It. They released 30,000 copies, of which I sold more than that in the city of London. You know, so there was never any economic possibility of bringing a band, you know, and a crew to do an American tour. You know, it was just, it would have compromised whatever we were generating everywhere else. So I decided, and then my daughter was extremely ill with bacterial meningitis, which, as you know, is a killer. And I was tortured by this because I was helpless, as you can imagine. But what came out of that was I realized a very simple and basic thing, that there was nothing I could do about her illness, but there were certainly things I could do about my career. So her illness and recovery gave me the balls to turn around and divorce my manager and take over the Whitesnake group of companies, and the rest is history. So I do thank my daughter, but she has more money than me in the old trust fund, you know. You want it slow?
It's lovely to be back home with you. Cheers.
Well, you can teach an old snake new tricks, apparently. I think what had happened was that John Culloden at Geffen had wanted Keith Olsen to remix the record for America. I was very disappointed because I had a wonderful friendship and relationship with Martin Birch, who was the engineer for all of the early Whitesnake records. In fact, the Deep Purple stuff, we just continued working together. So when I received a cassette of the American remix, I was so, so angry that the focus had been put on a matter of three songs out of whatever, 10, you know, like John's favorites or whatever, that I threw the cassette against the wall and stamped on it, and then Cozy jumped on it, thereby, you know, crushing it. And then I came over to do some shows, and I heard Slow and Easy and Slide It in a rental car we were using, on the radio, American, the wonderful compression that is American FM, and heard my voice in your face and all my, you know, dirty old man breathing, and I was going, Christ, I'm wrong. And in essence, that record, I think Eddie Rosenblatt, the president of Geffen, took me over for lunch when I got involved at that time with a company called Frontline Management, and he said, look, before anybody tells you this, we didn't really work Slide It In as much as we should, you know, should have. We, you know, broke even and made some money and then stopped. Now it's, I think, 4 million or something here. But, you know, that was extraordinarily disappointing for me to hear. However, you know, because things could have been a little bit different, but how can I turn around and complain with what ensued with the 87 record, you know? But the circumstance was, the very important lesson was, embrace American technology, because it was then pleasing. My record sounded competitive with, you know, all who were regarded as the big boys at that time. You know, and it made sense.
Yeah.
It's true, isn't it? I'm a dream to some and a nightmare to others. Huh? No, nobody, I must say, nobody's ever quit. Sorry, nobody's ever quit. Well, I put an awful lot into it. I've had all, you know, ankles, arms, wrists, you know, all kinds of stuff go. I do, you know, commit the entire being that is me to what I do, you know. That I bust a cartilage in a knee, which was 3 months, and, you know, leaping up and down like a Benzedrine mufti, you know. And that was 3 months in a cast, the original cast. And... And also, I think it was coming to the end of my overindulging in the peripheral aspects of the rock and roll circus. You know, overindulging, you know, the bits and pieces that I can never understand now when I see people doing it, you know, falling down drunk or comatose, chemically imbalanced. I think the reluctance to own up to age being an indication that recovery is not as immediate as it was before. And the other thing, I was listening to a great deal of my peers, and I heard they were losing their range or their attitude or, you know, love handles from hell, you know. And, you know, I really have never, ever wanted to become a bloated parody of what I was or conceived to be, you know. So it's just 1% Yorkshire common sense, you know, now and again. I don't, nowadays, I don't really drink anywhere near as much. I'm from the old school, Red. You know, if there's a bottle of wine there, I'll go, why not three? Oh, this must be the last bottle of Hennessy on the planet. I must drink it at one sitting, you know, and then expect to go out and hit those notes, you know, and also a bit set an example to my colleagues.
Donington, is this love?
Welcome back to In the Studio. I sound like a weatherman. And in Helena, Helena got 6 inches last night. Welcome back to In the Studio. I'm David Coverdale of Whitesnake talking to Redbeard. And there was two guitarists who I favored, European guitarists. One was a German kid called Michael Schenker, and the other one was Adrian Vandenberg, who played great rock guitar, but I could also hear that kind of memorable melodic stuff that I'd hear from Peter Green or Beck or the early Clapton, you know, those, and of course, Mr. Page. But I'd seen Michael, sadly, in assorted stages of, just conditions that I thought I would find difficult to coexist with. Distorted, or whatever. Do not adjust the horizontal. So I made the decision to approach, I think this is for Slide It In, correct me if I'm wrong here, Adrian Vandenberg, who I'd met and found to be a thoroughly charming man and continue to do so, and invited him to participate. Well, you know, he was an admirer of mine, a fan of the band, etc., etc. But at that time, they were experiencing success with a song called Burning Heart in America. So, you know, we've talked about this, obviously, a great deal. He said it tortured him, you know, for a week of going, what should I do? But I could understand, you know, it was his band, his baby, you know, the Vandenberg group. And he had to follow that path. I agree with that, you know. Otherwise, he would have been involved earlier. And the next thing, I think I'd heard this hotshot guitarist called John Sykes, who at that time was working with a fine English band called Thin Lizzy. Who was sadly on the way out, and the rest is history. Remember Phil Lynott? You know, great talent, but another one who embraced the peripherals, you know. A great loss. But so I actually engineered having Thin Lizzy on some Monsters of Rock festivals that I was doing in Germany to have a look at him, check him out. And so I invited him to join against the wishes of Cozy Powell. And the rest. And when he came over, he actually auditioned in the control room playing the old. I'd done a little Willie John song called Need Your Love So Bad, like with a church organ and me singing in a chapel in what was John Lennon's The Imagine Home, remember? In Ascot, in England, outside of London. And I said, just here, just play along with us and see. And he really didn't have a grasp of the blues at all. He was very hotshot, very fiery, you know. So, you know, that was the initial approach. And as I say, my colleagues weren't overly impressed, but I had a strange feeling that he would come in useful, if you'll excuse the expression. And that proved correct. Musically, he did. His personality far, far from endeared him for me.
Burning with a fever. I want
We were called the Snatch Magnet, I think, on that tour. So it's, forgive me, it's so politically incorrect. He lied. And quite honestly, I wish everybody, I'm very, very gracious in terms of, well done, go for it. You know what I'm saying? I did very well. I'm pretty well, you know, set up or whatever. But I'm a fan of music, and our entire industry, and people tend to forget this, is rooted, the entire foundation, in songs. Songs that touch people. You know, a song, for instance, like Here I Go Again. When I toured the rest of the world in 94, I was seeing really young people singing this. I'm going, you know what? I've actually written a relevant song. In you know, as the media would, who I regard as pretty much irrelevant, you know, in the big picture. You know, so what is the problem here? Why the blinkered perspective? You know, why don't people look at this and not aim for, you know, I have absolutely no aspirations or no dreams of being featured on MTV. You know, that's for the young lions. That's for the, you know, the new kids on the block, you know? That is not the scenario that I wish to approach. MTV saved me 3 to 5 years of hard touring, you know, with the exposure it gave me. Yeah, you know, it was a means to an end, you know? And I thank them for the support they gave me or whatever. But the circumstance is, there's more to life than MTV. I want to be the alternative to alternative music, you know? And it's strange because I came to America in 85 because I felt that the record company I was working with, EMI, in the rest of the world, they had a mentality of, we've made £5 profit, let's go to the pub and spend it, you know? And I came to America at the request of David Geffen and John David Colodner. And their mentality was, if you can make £5, why not £10? Why not 50? Why not 500? Ad infinitum. And I went, I like that. That's passionate and tenacious, you know? And it seems to me now the people I sit and speak to all complain. They're just all whining, you know? W-H-I-N, yeah, etc. And I'm going, well, you've promoted this. You deserve this. And it appears now I've renegotiated for the rest of the world, and the spirit and the gung-ho-ness or the don-ho-ness, the gung-ho-ness is great, you know, and it's great for me to, once again, as you were complimentary to the people in my life who surround me, it's positive, it's optimistic, let's go for it, you know? And that's one of the things that's filling my chest with pride.
Let's just deal right up front with the remarkable success in the second half of the 80s and then demise of Whitesnake.
Mm.
First, how many Whitesnake 1987 albums, the one featuring Here I Go Again and Still of the Night, how many did you sell worldwide?
14 million. Yeah, it's a lot of records, and fortunately still chipping away. It's very reassuring.
14 million, just on that one alone. And then the follow-up, Slip of the Tongue.
5 million. That was the last,
Five million? So let's say...
Somebody out there likes it.
Yeah. So in a...
the Gospel of the Snake. Mm.
In a couple year span, you sold just under, to date, 20 million albums on...
Within 3 years, I think.
Yeah, in 3 years, okay. In hindsight, the obvious question is, what happened?
I'd had quite enough, thank you, to be honest. I was questioned at the end of, during 1990, I was a terribly, terribly confused chap, which is not half one of those cowboy leggings you use, it's a guy, okay? I was privately and professionally. I'd really lost focus of the blues roots and the blues bass that that I'd always wanted to use as a vehicle for songwriting and performing. And gotten caught up with the Moose Abuse, the videos, the over flamboyance and stuff. I think had I done any more, I would have ended up in a frilly shirt, and that's not what I got into it for in the first place. Everything that seemed to be important was not the reasons why I got into it in the first place.
Okay,
I'd actually retired.
Let me play devil's advocate for just a second, though. I'm certainly not disputing anything you say. You were there. I wasn't. But from the... from our perspective as fans, what after saying you sold 19 million albums in 3 years, and you say you wanted to get out of it, I'm not sure I'm clear on what it was. So it almost sounds like you had to get away from yourself.
No, I had to rediscover. I believe for a particular period of time, because everything was just activity all the time, I wasn't convinced that I had the same passion, and that's what it is.
Okay.
It's passion. And I have no right to abuse anybody who's followed me or enjoys my work by pretending that part isn't in me.
Can you relate to the, it's almost a cliche now, but can you relate to the saying that be careful what you wish for because it might come true?
Oh, of course. Absolutely. It just really escalated out of my control. Forgive me, not so much control, more perspective. And I needed, if not a serious period of reflection. It was it's very important for me to discover how I'm building as a person, let alone as a musician, which are hopelessly intertwined anyway.
Right.
And the only way I could do that was the most indulge in the most precious commodity, certainly in my life, which is time. So I, in essence, without really telling anybody, I'd retired to Tahoe in Nevada. Well, yes, being particularly at that time, fortunately, I'm not $3 million in debt this time, but that, you can imagine, was quite an anchor at that. Not a Paul, a Paul anchor, sorry. A seriously heavy iron big ship anchor, you know, but as, you know, it is, it's just I'm really excited. I'm absolutely distressed by the attitude of a lot of American record companies. It's just, where is the spirit? Where is the passion? You know, I see so many artists that were very successful in the 80s and stuff. They just go, oh, no, there's no room for you. I mean, it's just unbelievable. It's disappointing because, number one, I don't bleat. You know, I'm not a... oh, man, I should have this and I should have... I don't take anything for granted. But I've got a very solid piece of work here. By no stretch of the imagination is it Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band or whatever. But the circumstance is, I'm going to drag this by the nipples and the pubic hairs to make it extraordinarily successful. And then we shall find how deep their pockets really are. You know, because I am not getting on my hands and knees for people who go, you know what, I don't know what we could do with this. Promote it, man. It's called work. Have you forgotten the ethic? You know? And I see so many talented people who are berated for for being successful in the 80s. And it's not just musicians. I see it in album artists and photographers and people who are affiliated and engineers, producers. You know, they're just dropped like hot potatoes. It's bizarre. It really is bizarre.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Where's the BBC not wanting us to say?
I'd gone to visit my mother in the north of England, and she'd recently... Do you call it spring cleaning over here when you... Okay, she'd been spring cleaning and had come across a bunch of cassettes from my time with the fabled Deep Purple. And it was really wild listening to the original ideas of songs like Mistreated and Soldier of Fortune or whatever. And then I found stuff that we never used, you know, utilized. And one piece was like me being the closet guitar hero that I am, messing about with a kind of Jimi Hendrix Band of Gypsies thing. So I'd actually rented a house in the spring, early summer of 85 to do this writing in the south of France, a village called Le Riol. So I fleshed it out there, and Sykes came in and put the bite on it and stuff, you know, on the Still of the Night hook. But the music was basically much, much older, or the original idea. You know, it was back from the Purple time. So, you know, suddenly this is why I don't think there's age to music. I think there's age to fashion, you know. But a good song, I don't think, ever goes out of style. But anyway, I think it was all those portents. There was remarkable versatility and variety on MTV at that time. Everybody in America was fascinated to put on this very agreeable 24-hour-a-day, you know, visual radio. And Geffen were completely behind it. We planted the seeds with a Slide It In record at radio. It was a remarkable reward. And I was at a time of a maturity that I accepted it with great dignity, I felt, which has always been a passion of mine, to be able to accept things with dignity and grace. And it just felt like a wonderful pat on the back, you know, really for, or whatever. And it just kept going, and evidently still is. You know?
In the still of the night, I hear the woman honey sniffing around your door. In the still of the night, I feel my heart beating heavy, telling me I'm gonna have more. Thank you for your remarkable hospitality, Donington. I had to thank God for such a wonderful day. The Magnificent Thunder, Choir Boys, Poison, Aerosmith, and your good selves.
This is Redbeard in the studio. Thanks so much to David Coverdale. In the studio is copyright 2020. All rights reserved. Bearded Fish.